The chair's inviting me to kick off. We're supposed to be keeping the peace. Right. Good evening, comrades and friends. What is the title of this talk? Oh, well, anyway, this talk about communist colonies in the United States. That's the basically the theme. And any title that we put on the website was made up hastily. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go through, talk about why this talk is even remotely relevant, since it's dealing with things that happened in the 19th century in a far off land, and the proximate causes for why I'm even talking about it, and look at some details of the role that communist colonies played in the settlement and the expansion of the United States, and give a little bit of a scale of the sorts of colonies and groups, societies that were engaged in that particular activity. And then look at some of the details, very sketchily, I'm afraid, around what they did, who they were, and talk a bit about three of the particular varieties, three of the societies that set up colonies, and then look at finally why they ultimately ceased to exist. And in the context of this one comes up all the time over the years, heard it many times, why don't we all just go together, form a communist commune, and show people how socialism could be. If we expand and we eventually build communes everywhere, then we can get rid of capitalism without having to have a nasty revolution. And we won't need to have all of this political strife or anything like that. We can just show them by a great example how things could be done differently. So the proximate reason why I'm giving this talk at all is during lockdown, I gave a talk to an outfit called the Oxford Communist Corresponding Society, in which I talked at length about how Marx and Engels really did have a clear idea of what socialism meant, or communism, for the purposes of our talk, could be either. And as part of that, I gave an example of Engels writing an article where he expressly talked about colonies, communist colonies in the United States. And I said at the time that I wasn't really concerned with whether or not they succeeded or failed. Engels was writing about how wonderful they were and how they provided some sort of proof that a community of goods is possible. And I said I was parking the idea that of assessing, against the actual history of what really happened next. With regards to Engels's claims, and also at the back of my mind, and I can't be going down hunting the reference. I'm pretty sure that the Trinidadian Trotskyist C.L.R. James was given a series of talks in the 1940s and 50s in the United States, and he said something along the lines of that when people in Europe were talking about democracy, they were doing it in America. And in a sense that there is a case that when people were talking about communism in Europe, they were doing it in America. And I once went to a talk where I kind of tweaked the nose of the speaker by saying that, well, this means that America is the home of world communism in a very real sense. So that's kind of the justification for why it's even remotely relevant. And I think that's, it's worth exploring because these are interesting stories. And what really kicked me off about when someone asked me if I was going to do a talk, and I had walked into a bookshop, and I can't see if this is coming up on the camera nicely. Yeah, there we go. It's all inverted. But I just saw this in a random Oxfam bookshop, which is Charles Nordhoff, the Communistic Societies of the United States. This was written in the 1870s and reprinted, interestingly enough, in I think the 1960s by a theological college publisher, which is significantly interesting and perhaps not all that entirely surprising. So it gave me, access to further information and a distinctly non-leftist, non-socialist source, who wrote about these things and was writing towards the end of Engels's life, so much later than Engels's article, which is for reference purposes entitled "Description of Recently Founded Communist Colonies Still in Existence," and that's from 1845. So this book is from 30 years after that. So and the colonies that he describes in his 1845 article were still extant in 1870. So that's proving that they had some longevity and some life in them. So one of the details I got from the Nordhoff book is that there were about eight societies in all that we could call communistic, socialistic societies that by the time he was writing, they'd founded 72 communes, 58 of which were belonging to one particular group, who I will address later on, but that's the Shakers. And the Shakers seem to have been the most successful commune society in the United States. And he reckoned about 5,000 people lived in these communes on about 150,000 acres of land. So we're not talking about a vast number of people. In fact, the Wikipedia article says that through the lifespan of the Shakers, about 20,000 people passed through and lived in the settlements. So never more than a handful of villages. But as the authors of the preface to the Nordhoff reprint point out, this does belong in the context of reconsidering the great myth of individualism on the frontier, that these communes and colonies like this did play a considerable part, and in terms of that, this is the expressly communistic ones, but you've also got things like the Mormons, who were constantly setting up, founding cities and founding new settlements, and then being forced to move on by mob violence because of their peculiar practices, as were seen at the time. So it's in some ways it's a useful corrective to say, well, there was this element of collective action involved in the setting up of the settlement or the mass migration of Europeans into North America. Of course, we have to be aware of, there were people there already and living quite successfully, but being driven out. And obviously, in this context, it was the relative affordability of land and also that there were governments seeking settlers that enabled people to put forward these particular projects. And it seems that time and again, Robert Owen and the Owenites do seem to have played a part, certainly in the Harmonist and the Icarian settlements. So there was clearly an element of this was an idea that was being practically applied. And in some ways, it's important to note that the lives of these communistic societies were not that different from the lives of frontier people. I mean, the Nordhoff describes them as being very well off in some material ways, but frugal materiality, but in terms of leisure time and comfort and access to clothing and housing and things like that, that they were they were not far apart from the people who were struggling along in individual maybe farmsteads throughout the frontier. So that's something to take into account when considering this idea that these people came over and forged this new idea in the real world and gave practical examples of what a communist society actually is. So some general points I wanted to spot up that come across from Nordhoff's book, that These are, in fact, he says expressly one of them. Which one is it? Itself, it eventually became practically the Aurora community is in fact a joint stock company, and just becomes a successful business in its way of operation. So that these are not completely divorced from the commercial world, and things like the Shakers were fairly preponderant. Apparently, they pioneered selling seeds in packets in the United States. So they sold they sold their seed onwards, and made quite substantial amounts of money. And although some of the organizations, the Harmonists, tried to live self-sufficiently, they always had some element of some need for commercial life. Even the avowedly secular communists of the Icarians themselves had to live by selling wool and pigs. So chiefly, most of these were agricultural setups, although some of them, the Shakers themselves, became quite adept at producing machine tools and selling furniture. So they were not just simple subsistence farmers. One thing that came out that surprised me, that probably hadn't thought, shouldn't have surprised me, from the Nordhoff book, is that some of these organizations actually had paid workers that they hired. I think the Perfectionists, and certainly I think it's some of the Harmonists had hired local hands. And in some ways, this is, you could argue, it's slightly hypocritical of them, and it's not unheard of. I mean, the modern day equivalent is that we know that the kibbutzim employ quite a lot of external laborers. So you've got this distinction between the members of the commune, and because they have a need for labor that's greater than the willingness of people to come and join in and be a full member of the society, they end up having these sort of like, as Paddy was joking slightly before we started, layers of membership within, and of course, it is an interesting question about the viability. How much did they actually have to depend upon being able to hire in external workers and live within the relationship with the local communities? But by the same token, interestingly enough, it does discuss how they also annoyed some of the local communities that had joined them, not just through, as we'll come to a bit later, the sexual proclivities, but that also that they would buy wholesale from New York rather than buying from local markets, because they had that sort of clout, and that this was resented. So, in a way, we can, while we can talk about them as abolishing commodity relationships within the commune, they are still very much embedded within the overall commodity relation of the United States. And obviously, they needed the seed capital, in the case of the Shakers, literally, clearly, to set themselves up. And in fact, I think I'm letting my French down here. I think he's pronounced Cabet, or Cabet, who found the founder of the Icarian, said if he had $500,000, he would set up this wonderful commune. Please give me $500,000. Well, of course, the French anarchists who were with him did not have $500,000 in order to set this up. So clearly, I'll come to some other points about them, but I just want to give a brief background on the Shakers. Now, they're quite interesting. Let's see if I've got the Wikipedia article still to hand, because they are, the full and proper title is the United Brethren, United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Appearing. And apart from communal living, the other significant feature of the Shaker communities is that they practice celibacy. They forbade marriage within their organization, and so this is the largest and longest lived communistic society in the United States, because they started their settlements really begin in about the oldest one 1792, I think, and the last one that was oh, there's still one that's officially present going to the present day. Sabbath Day Lake Shaker Village in Maine, founded in 1794, but I suspect there's no one living there. I'll have to look that one up. But most of them, the final ones, really gave up the ghost in the 1960s. So between, so that is for an organisation that's living entirely on recruitment, quite a remarkable achievement. And they did become quite famous for their architecture, their buildings, and their furniture. And of course, interestingly, apparently they would have. It's just an aside. I'd love to know more about it, but I don't have the time to really dig into these things in massive detail. They would take on what they called winter shakers, so they'd have people who weren't necessarily willing to join the society, but who were willing to come and live with them through the winter, and they would work, and then leave again without actually ever joining. And in some ways, again, that's a form of drawing in external labour, I suppose, setting this bar on, and it's quite a serious bar that, you say absolutely no to marriage and complete celibacy, and then therefore that they had communal living. They actually had joint living quarters where they had families, as they called them, that were actually just basically, housemates. And they were organized. I mean, the Nordhoff, as a writer, he's fairly determined that only the authoritarian sects were any good. And he derides the more democratic ones. So clearly, is in some ways a hostile witness, I think. But he does make the we have to take on his observation that only those sects that had a strong leadership. Only those communes, sorry, that had a strong leadership, survived. And the Shakers themselves did not practice democracy as such. I mean, it's a loose form of democracy, in as much as anyone could just walk away. There was no requirement to stay. People clearly did leave because that's how they died off. But that they were organised into bishoprics with deacons who were in charge of provisioning for each family. So. Which I'll come back to that as a point about Engels's article a little bit later. So I've already mentioned them as well, the perfectionists, and I wanted to flag them up as well because they were the kind of the absolute flip side of the Shakers. In as much as they again, they were a Christian or a Christian offshoot sect, so another religious foundation, but they practiced polyamory, and quite determinedly so, by the sounds of it. I suspect that celibacy would have been actually frowned upon within their organisation. And also they believed in what can only be described as religious quackery. I mean, they believed in faith healing and the power of prayer, but they also were proselytic. They produced the newspaper saying, we are the perfectionists, and these are our communes. Come and join our ways. And they had two or three communes running at a given time, quite successfully and for quite some while. I've not got the Wikipedia article in front of me. I'm sure we could all look these things up later. That's not the point of the talk to just ventriloquize Wikipedia in your general direction. But the point is again that we have that this is and apparently the neighbors, considering that the stick the Mormons got for their polygamy, the polyamory of the perfectionists didn't actually antagonize the neighbors. I think they were just kind of seen as, well, they're a bit strange, but we won't go there. But they survived and had a relatively democratic internal structure, if I recall. And the third society I just wanted to emphasize is, I've come back to them, is Cabes Icarians. Set off in the 1840s, and they were determinedly non-religious. They actually, although they had Sunday as a day of rest, it was a non-religious day of rest. Their religion was that they wanted to set up a communist society and to make it thrive. Now Nordhoff says that this was the they were the worst organized of the lot, and it sounds like vociferous arguments did ensue, and there were failures to the extent that apparently Cabet himself was sued in the French courts for fraud over the setting up of their various. I mean, they tried in Texas and they had to move to Iowa and all sorts of trials and tribulations. But they lasted for a good chunk of years and beyond Cabet's existence. And of course, this is an interesting thing that he, although they had a democratic constitution, he very much was the dictator of the organization. But even once he was removed, it survived as a democratic organization. And they very much had the principle that although they had directors who, a president, sorry, who had powers, he couldn't so much as spend a penny without the say so of the weekly communal meetings. So he was charged from week to week with via democracy. Now Nordhoff sneers that this is obviously the reason for their failure was that they did not have strong and vibrant and determined leadership. Just to some more detail on a different group, the Harmonists, I think this is, who were set up by a fellow called Rapp. Yes, that's the one. Who lived in families of 20 to 40 individuals, each of which had a separate house and domestic establishment. The family gets its supplies as much as it requires from the common stores. They have abundance for all and all get as much as they wish without charge. When they need clothing, they apply to the head tailor, the head seamstress, or the shoemaker and are furnished with it and made to their taste. Flesh, meat, and other foods are divided among the families according to the number of individuals in each, and in everything they have abundance and plenitude. That's a fellow called Finch that Engels quotes at length. And they had fairly clear constitution. They have three managers elected each year, but who remained in office at length, a director and a council and a paymaster. And I'm just mentioning some of these things because when you called on to think about it, things like within the Rappists, within the Harmonists, they had to get permission to get married. Which sounds, on the face of it, awful. But then again, you go, it's not just getting permission; it's also then getting a home. It's getting the establishment of the household set up because the community will go, okay, fine, you're a new couple. We will now set you up accordingly. And I missed out about the Icarians. The Icarians, although they were the secular ones, they had a principle that everyone should be married. And it was look there was penalties if anyone stayed unmarried for a significant amount of time, but of course presumably the kind of material reason being that they wanted to reproduce their community. I should add that they, I mean, as far as Nordhoff is concerned, they made a religion. They kind of had a secularized religion that brought it together. So this brings me to religion, I think, as a general point, and Engels kind of addresses it closely as well, and I think Nordhoff likewise, is religion a requirement for these communes to work? And it's clear that the argument is no, that it doesn't have to be religion, although that what they needed was a clear, conscious binding force, a binding idea to bring these people together and keep them together. and to keep them in a fairly close-pecked way of life. I think he says in some way, nod of among the Shakers, you know, that they would have to, you'd have to, apart from once or twice a week, people would have to know where you were at all times, because you know they needed, you know, you need to account for where you were and what you were doing and the work that you were about. And everyone was required to work, so there was a general lack of privacy. And even, like I say, the secular Icarians needed the idea of communism in order to bind themselves together to get the society, as Nodov points out, to survive through some quite significant tribulations and poverty to get to the point at which it was a viable community. It's an interesting question. So Nordhoff is quite clear that democracy is not a strong requirement. Engels, in his write-up, doesn't really talk about democracy as such, and he seems to not mind if some of the seeming setups are fairly authoritarian, in as much as they have, apart from the whole general, it's a voluntary association. If there's one person holding the purse strings, and keeping everything together, he seems to not be overly concerned or fetishizing about them being a democratic society in the way that, you know, to the extent that the of the Icarians determinedly being democratic and not, and having weekly meet, well, essentially the equivalent of a weekly branch meeting that we would have. I mean, we would recognize, I think, from our own organization, that you know the idea that annual election of posts is one thing, but that generally someone stays in post at the leisure, and until, you know, it's very rare that we will sack someone from a post. So I think that's just an interesting feature that I think is worth noting about the setup, is that someone really, they were determinedly egalitarian, so that these people did not become dictators over them. But there is clearly an issue that's worth looking at in that area. And I had a point that I've not written down here related to that. Oh yes. So in my talk, my original talk that this is stemming from, I'd made the point that Engels and Marx had said that keeping the accounts is a key part of socialism. And one of the things I just picked up flicking through the Nordhoff in preparation for this was he was unable to get adequate detail of exactly how much wealth these societies had. In some cases, apart from the Aurora Society, which, as he says, was essentially a business, because after a certain point, it just became too bothersome for them to keep accounts. They just didn't bother what was within the community. They didn't need accounting for, because they had plenty, and as long as they were, everyone was happy and it was all working. The accounts were fairly minimal, and although they had books, all of these societies have a central account book that is available to the community. It's kept centrally, and someone controls it. It does seem that, to a certain extent, that they didn't write down every rivet. So the question is this scalable? I mean, and does this represent what we would understand, or many people would understand, as example, really real breathing examples of what a communist stroke socialist society would be like, if extended to a wider scale? I mean, if you know, if we take, you know, the Kropotkinite ideal, I mean, the Kropotkinite ideal really would be self-sustaining villages doing some sort of arrangement of intercourse to share resources that can't be obtained locally, and is it desirable? Can this be scaled up in any meaningful way? It's worth looking at possibly why they declined. Now, one example, I think, that's somewhere in Kautsky, he kind of says they declined because the narrow lifestyle that was required was just unsupportable. People just left. It's not possible because they were narrow communities of consumption, essentially. There's what they held was the means of light consumption rather than means of general production. And he, I think, kind of tries to distinguish between these communal setups and the future socialist society, which will be much more generalized. Of course, his view, that's very much more a centralized, nationalized style of setup rather than the sort of like the anarcho-communist, everyone living in little communes all over the place kind of model. So of course he'd think that. However, it's worth noting that yes, they existed because at the time they were not materially poorer than anyone else. That it was possible to live largely on the land from 130, 150,000 acres of land supporting 5,000 people or so. It's eminently doable and slightly lower, Nordhoff reckons, than the general population of America, but maybe they were getting more efficient use of their land through communal living. But the editors of the Nordhoff reprint also note things like the increase of transport, national government coming along, and the means of communication changing so that these communes could no longer isolate themselves from the general population as readily, and they could not be left alone because obviously they need to be taxed, they need to be treated as part of the United States of America. And of course, the other thing that comes along is the advent of industrial society, the industrial changes that happened in the late 1870s would prove a challenge. And also, I think that one feature that clearly comes through is splits and disputes, which is hardly unsurprising. We would know this, that people fell out and went off and set up rival communes, which either succeeded or failed. Nordhoff reckons that around 45, so he's saying that there are about 70 communes that are set up and living, but there's 45 over the same period that have failed. And so there's this kind of to say it works is a kind of a survivor bias, that those that have survived have told us that they're the ones that show how it can work. But obviously there's a bit of a filter there regarding how to be successful. So just to try and sum up, so basically, coming out of a previous talk about what Marx and Engels understood, they had a clear idea of what socialism struck communism is in practice, and that this was being done in America, and that there were different societies where they had different ideologies but fairly similar practices, but varying degrees of authority within the communes. And that the communes themselves, it's a question of how successful they were. Some societies did last for well over 100 years before eventually declining, and some only lasted with one generation. And there's an even wider open question about to what extent this particular model of setting up communes is a viable picture of what socialism would be like, much less the idea that it might be a good plan to buy a Scottish island. And of course, I've looked up websites. You can look for websites with Scottish islands for sale. However, they're clearly the sort of websites that assume that if you have to ask the price, you don't have enough money, because they don't list the prices of Scottish islands. Damn them. So I don't think we're going to be doing that anytime soon. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to join in with questions, contributions, and general ignorance. Cheers.